Well, it's really wonderful to be here, and what a fabulous exhibition. Well done. It's really wonderful to walk into, and you'll have a chance afterwards when the chairs are put away to spend some time with these truly remarkable images. So we've got about 40, 45 minutes here. We'll speak for maybe half an hour together in conversation, and then there'll be time for questions together, and then we'll also be here for another 10 or 15 minutes if you want to ask individual questions. I'm the Contemporary Art Curator at the Royal Albert Memorial Museum, an art gallery in Exeter, which is in Devon. So, the other county. And I met Sarah a few years ago now.
Yes.
At an exhibition at Make Southwest.
Yeah.
And then after that, the museum was able to commission Sarah to create new work inspired by our collections, and we have an incredible collection of moths as part of the wider collections at the museum, and we'll talk a bit about that later. First of all, I'd like to start by talking about drawing and observation and thinking about drawing and what inspires you.
Yes, okay, so drawing is foundational. So that you might, those of you who are tuned in will know that there's drawing is on that wall and mezzotint is on that wall. That's how it's been made. So I wanted to thank you for asking me so directly about drawing. We lost a grand old painter last week. And I thought, I won't read from notes, but I did make some notes in order that I don't completely lose myself. I thought I might start by quoting the great man in his honour. So David Hockney said, "The act of drawing forces the artist to slow down, take note of details, and look at the world in a new way." I do think that drawing is really about noticing. It's about being alert, being aware, and then showing what you see in a way that speaks to others. It's the act of noticing, of translating what you see and feel, that gives drawing its profound significance. And he went on to say that, "I believe the very process of looking can make a thing beautiful. I believe that the very process of looking can make a thing beautiful." And I think I would answer the question, where is drawing? That is why we draw. I'm a card-carrying believer in drawing. I believe in drawing and poetry. Those are the two things. And I think, and by that I don't mean that in a reactionary sort of, you should learn to draw. Can't do anything else, you should have learned to draw. I don't mean it in that sense. I mean it in the sense of, well, exactly what Hockney's saying, the excitement and the engagement and the attention that comes through drawing is foundational. It's the beginning. And even if what you're paying attention to is your dreams or a narrative, a story, in that process of drawing, you are engaging.
And you have a lot of notebooks, don't you?
I have a lot of notebooks. I keep notebooks. My notebooks are full of shopping lists of moths. But also drawings.
Very, very beautiful drawings.
Thank you. And drawings. It's the thing. I mean, I think what it is with drawing is that when you draw something, when you pay attention to something and you draw it, I'm wondering how. It's very hard to put into words what it does, but it's more than just a way. It's a way of engaging with the world, and it's a way of engaging with the world that refuses to see the world as animate, as just inanimate objects, as reduced to things. What you're doing is you're pulling out of the world, or pushing, you're putting yourself forward and backwards and forwards with a world that is animate, that is mad, crazy, magical, and comes towards you if you make yourself open to it. And I think that drawing does that.
Do you prefer to go outdoors to draw, or is it dependent on the weather at all?
Yeah, I mean, you just get the paper gets soggy in the rain. That's as practical as that. But it's
Does it take you out into the world? Yeah, imaginatively.
It has become the way, my way of engaging with the world and my way of being in a world that I believe to be animate and communicative, for want of a better word. But you've got to be in conversation. You've got to put yourself in that place of conversation. And I think that the business of drawing is, or the process of drawing, and the practice. I mean, this word practice is very, very overused now. Everybody says, my practice this, my practice that. I mean practice in the sense of something you've done for years stretching back and will do for years stretching forward, and you put your hours and hours and hours in. And that practice has the effect of opening.
Does it take you back? I was just thinking about being a small child and being on the floor drawing or drawing with my children. I mean, does it have a kind of memory process for you?
Well, it was a solace when I was an unhappy teenager. Right. I didn't know how to be in the world. I did know how to draw. So it takes me back to that. It's always been there for me.
Yes.
I mean, I'm talking to a room where half the population of this room is artists, so half of them will know what I mean. It's the thing that you turn to when you... it's about the only decent bit of advice I was given at art school. I remember being stuck one time and bumping into one of the tutors on the train, saying, I'm stuck, I don't know, so I'm going to London. And she just said, draw and draw intelligently, which went in. And that's what I'm talking about. It's that drawing without an expectation that I'm going to draw like this, or this is even what I'm going to draw. Half the time when you're drawing, you draw something and you're tired and you've done it, you've been drawing the same thing for an hour, and you turn around to pack up and you start... It's the thing that you then do.
Yes. Yeah. And where was the art school?
I went to the Ruskin, which I was miserable at.
I was going to ask.
Yeah. It's not good. I went to Paris first. So basically the quick biography bit is that I was not great at school. And when I left school, I moved home to my father, and I I'd failed to get myself into any university or art school, or done. I just hadn't done it, hadn't done the forms, had been not concentrating. And he had that kind of wonderful migrant mentality of, well, we'll just go somewhere else. If you're going to be an artist, you better go to Paris, he said.
Wow.
So he...
So what did you get up to in Paris?
Well, he didn't speak any French, but he knew a man who did, sort of thing. And he...
Brilliant.
It's just that amazing sort of can-do. He rang a few art schools in Paris and said, I have this talented daughter. How do we get into... You know... Very different from now. It's just how do we be here? How do we get into this art school?
Yeah.
And then what I remember was getting up at 5 a.m. and putting my A-level portfolio into the back of the car and driving to Dover with him. And we went and I interviewed at various art schools in Paris, and I ended up in a very small art school outside Paris, run by an extraordinary Trinidadian professor who'd been at the Royal College and had been involved in the 1968 riots and had been involved in the civil rights movement in America, and was the most cultured, extraordinary person, and taught this highly disciplined form of painting, which was Van Eyck's technique, which is that you draw, then you make an imprimatur of one colour, then you heighten the whites, then you paint a monochrome underpainting, and then you... paint, this will be familiar to painters, that you paint in temperate into wet oil glazes. Very rigid, very formal method of painting. It's why the Van Eycks are so immaculate still. And it was just what I needed as a completely lost...
So you were learning painting then?
I was learning painting. But I was a completely lost kind of teenager. Late teenager, and this extraordinary discipline, and he just made us work and work and work and work, and hours of drawing. I was allowed one pencil when I got there, and then after a week he said, okay, you can have a...
Well, you've got a lovely collection of pencils.
I've got a lovely collection of pencils. You can have another pencil, you can have an H pencil and a B pencil and then a 2B and a 2H, and until I, you know, it was literally that discipline. Okay, you can have paint.
And
he got my box of paints out and just said, absolutely, you're not using them. They're disgusting, he said. And this was the 1970s when they still made paint and things like flesh tint and stuff like that. I mean, all wrong. So he sent me off into Paris to to spend money, and I went, I can't spend this money. And he said, don't buy clothes for a year, you can, you know. It was really tough with me, really tough with me, and it was exactly what I needed, and I did a year there, and then I applied to Oxford from there and went to the Ruskin from there.
And did you do any printmaking at the Ruskin?
So at the Ruskin, I arrived at the painting school with this already formed and very stylized sort of Van Eyck. I'm painting like Van Eyck. You know, here I am with my music, my business. And they hated me immediately, and it was horrible. And I hated them, and I was young and arrogant and thought I already knew how to paint. And it went badly wrong, and I took refuge in the print room.
Right.
And the print room was full of generous technicians and lots of interesting presses and smelt great, and nobody, I didn't know what I was doing, which is a much better way to be in the world when you don't know what you're doing than when you think you do know what you're doing. So I did 3 years printmaking, pretty much.
But not Metz-a-Tint.
I did one Metz-a-Tint.
Oh, you did?
I did do one Metz-a-Tint, yeah. Right. I did one Metz-a-Tint and thought, oh, yeah, this is interesting. And then weirdly left art school and went straight back to painting.
Right.
So, which is an odd
thing. So I'm just wondering if we all know about the process of making a Metz-a-Tint, because I think it's quite an extraordinary and elaborate and very beautiful process. So would you like to hear about the process of making Metz-a-Tint? So here behind us we have the plates.
Yep.
And you don't, have you ever shown them in an exhibition before?
I've never shown them in an exhibition before, and I've been wanting to. And that's actually not true. Meryl Ainslie's here from Radley Gallery, and she often shows a plate to people to. It does help people to understand. So Metz-a-Tint. I don't know, almost don't know where to begin. There's almost kind of.
Well, you've written about Metz-a-Tint beautifully in the new publication, which I recommend.
Yeah. There's two short essays in the new book. One is kind of the magical how, why bit, and the other essay is the how bit. So if I do the how bit first, then maybe I'll try and get onto the more poetic bit. So the how bit. So Metz-a-Tint was invented in about the 1640s. It was invented by, as really often happens, two different men at the same time, simultaneously in different parts of Europe, came to a solution. And they were looking for, so line engraving had been mastered and had been around for centuries and was used to reproduce paintings. And then when oil painting really got underway and we got the beautiful sfumato and chiaroscuro that you get with oil painting that was not really so present in tempera painting or wall painting, they needed a way to reproduce the paintings that could somehow express that extraordinary thing when something turns away from you into the dark or comes out into the light. And the quite separately, these two, one's, I'm going to fail to remember their name, one is Prince Rupert. One was a prince and the other was a soldier. So I don't think there were many professional artists in that, you know, but people were doing other things. Anyway, they came across this way. What they did was they abraded the copper plate to start off with, and they did that. I mean, in those days, you've got to remember, you didn't go to Cornelison's or wherever and buy a tool. They would have been adapting and making their own tools or having them made. And I'm pretty sure that what they did was adapt a chisel to start off with. So they would have had tempered steel and chisels. And you have a thing that looks like a curved. I have actually bought my tools with me, so if we go next door afterwards, I can show you what it is. But it's a bit like a herb chopper, a curved blade, but it's serrated like that, with 100 serrations per inch. So a pretty extraordinary thing. And you rock the plate. You move it backwards and forwards across the plate like that.
Incredibly physical.
Incredibly physical. Yeah. And the thing tracks. It's got a beveled edge and a straight down edge, and it tracks across the plate, making these grooves and pits. Little tiny mountains.
And do you have to do that 40, 50 times?
More. So you go all across the plate in one direction, and then you go in the other direction, and then that direction, and then that direction. I mean, Hogarth said 64 times. I don't really think anybody rocks a plate in 64 directions, but it's multiples of 4 and 8.
Right.
And then what you create a surface on the copper that is, if you can imagine looking at a Chinese mountainscape, you know, those very pointy mountains that you see in pictures of China. It's like that in microcosm. So you've got pits, and you've also got like dry point burns. It's very closely related to dry point. But if you think of a bed of nails, the dry points, because there's multiple burrs, they're not as vulnerable as in a regular dry point print. So once you've done that to the surface, if you printed that, it prints black. It prints the most extraordinary physical black that you can see behind that mop. There is probably the clearest, easiest place to see it. And it's very hard, it just basically all the ink sits in it. With intaglio, what you're doing is you're putting the ink into all the pits, and then you're wiping. And there's nothing, you can't wipe anything off it. It just prints back no matter how hard you want. And then what you do with these scrapers and burnishers is you start to take those little mountains, put my hands up here so that you can see them. If you imagine that's one of them, you start to take the top off them so that they have little flat plains or plateaus on the top of them, which effectively makes a dot scale. So you get little areas that print white and bigger areas that print black where the ink is still sitting in the valleys. And if you do that enough, what happens is that those areas of white get bigger and bigger, and the valleys which are holding the ink get smaller and smaller. So it's a dot scale. You know, you're doing that. But it takes, you know, you're scraping copper with steel. It takes a long time. So you're working in mirror.
And to achieve the grey tones?
The grey tones are what are magical. The grey tones are what is completely magical. So they've come up with this method which allows them to make softness in print. As pre-aquatint photography, pre-lithography, pre-everything, in a way. So it's obsolete, because all of those things have come along, and each time one of those things has come along and done it better, easier, cheaper.
And in terms of the moths, I mean, it's an incredible technique to create those kind of furry moths. I mean, it seems to be the most appropriate technique.
Well, I think I got lucky. I mean, I got... This is the bit that's really hard to talk about, because what I noticed with moths, I've been painting landscapes, and what I noticed with moths was their absence was the first thing I noticed about 15 years ago. I think you couldn't really avoid, most people have noticed that they've gone, or they're not coming in the room anymore, are they, when you read at night. So I noticed an absence, I got interested in them, I started making drawings and dry points and things, and thought, I don't really want to make entomological drawings. It's not what I'm doing, so I was looking for a way of working that contained absence within it. It's the only way I can think of that had a sort of. And mezzotint is entirely, almost entirely about what's not really there.
Yeah, it's searching for
something. You're inquiring all the time. Yeah. Are you there? Where are you? Are you here? Is this right? You know? So that's how it came, and the two kind of. Came at the same time.
Together.
Yeah, I feel very lucky.
That, I mean, I found Sarah through her mezzotints and seeing the work in other exhibitions, and that's when we were very keen to work with Sarah at the museum. And already, you were visiting my colleague in our off-site stores.
I was.
Because you were working with Cambridge University.
I think I met Holly first. So I think I used the Exeter collection first
Before you went to Cambridge.
Before I went to Cambridge, I was invited to go and do something in Cambridge with them at the Zoology Museum to look at moths that are on the edge of extinction. We have quite a lot in this country that are now so vulnerable; they're just on that very edge. The garden tiger being one. But the work I was doing at Exeter was with quite common British moths. So I think that's where we met. I was going into the stores.
Yeah.
And Holly said, Lara would like to meet you. And I was like, really? I'm busy drawing.
So originally we thought, and you are known for your beautiful mezzotints, that it would be a mezzotint that you created. But then after a number of meetings and conversations, you decided... quite rightly, I think, to work in charcoal. So the commission is on the wall to my right. It's a series of four frame pieces, and it's of the tiger moth.
The garden
which,
tiger.
Has declined by 90% in my lifetime.
Our lifetime.
54. So, yeah. And you've chosen to draw it. You've drawn it four times, actually.
Yep.
And do you want to say something about the process and how we experience it?
Yes, well, I think I probably ought, first of all, to thank you for your patience with me, because I think my way of working is actually rather similar to Mezzotint, which is, it's kind of a constant, is it this, is it that? It's not a pre-seeing, it's a kind of, is it here, is it there? So I said to you I was going to do one thing. I think I said to you, Karen, I was going to do something completely different for this exhibition, and then it manifested a different way. I mean, that just seems to be, so I'm so grateful to people who just go, yes, Sarah, it's fine, just keep working. So I wanted to make... Lara asked me to work for an exhibition called Wild, which was a big natural history museum exhibition, really, wasn't it?
Manchester Museum.
Yeah. Wasn't an art. It was.
Well, it wasn't an art exhibition. No.
Yeah.
No.
So she said, "Would you do that?" And I thought, I can't talk about Wild without talking about extinction, and so I knew that I needed to find a subject that was visually appealing, would grab people, that I needed to address extinction. Really needed to address extinction as it's happening now, not as a historic thing, but as it is happening in an accelerated form now. And what was weird was I'd ordered the copper plates and I thought, this is fine, I can do this in Mezzotint, and then just absolutely couldn't. I couldn't, having made things appear in Mezzotint for years, I couldn't make things disappear in Mezzotint. I think that's what happened, and I got myself stuck, and you came to the studio and very patiently said, it's okay, it's just... You know, it'll be okay, just keep working. And the charcoal, I was having a lovely conversation with you yesterday about carbon, wasn't I? About the carbon black, suddenly something clicked in my mind and I thought, you know, we will all return to carbon and it is the beginning of all things. And suddenly the carbon of charcoal seemed right, and then they came quite easily. So the Garden Tiger, for those of you who don't know, it is was an incredibly common moth. It was, I mean, there's another little project here we can talk about, the text in that, which is from written in about 1920, describes it as a gaudy but common moth. And it's dying out because with warmer winters, the caterpillars are emerging too quickly, too soon, and then being predated or rotting or getting ill, or just generally they're out of time for their food plant, which is called phenology. So something I learned, phenology, things being in the right time with their plant. So we made them for the show, and it all came quite quickly once we started. Yeah. And the all black one, do you want to say something, sorry?
Well, I was just thinking that it is... A very upsetting subject.
It
but
is.
Actually, you also describe being able to read it in the other direction, which...
Yeah, so I have always been interested in Eastern thought and the idea, particularly Taoism, and the idea of that everything emerges, all the 10,000 things that constantly emerge from absence into presence and fall back into absence. So they have a totally different notion of what absence is. So for us, absence is a lack, someone or something that's missing. Whereas I think my understanding of Taoism is that absence is a generative, pregnant thing. Hello, Custard. Are you coming for a chat? Custard has appeared out of the generative void. Yeah, their view is that everything comes out of this darkness that is a pregnant darkness. And so you can read them that way. And I like the idea also that many, many moths spend their cocoon period of time in the soil, in the dark, for a long period of time. There's a leopard moth over there, which is a Mezzotint right down the end. That spends up to 4 years inside a tree in the larval stage, doing nothing, just in the darkness inside the wood. And then it emerges when it's ready. So I really like the idea that they could also be read that way. And I think we have to be hopeful. Conservation works. We have to be... We have to do things. We can't just go, oh, God, it's all gone. You know?
So I know people who came to the exhibition in Exeter really responded to that. I mean, they learned a great deal and responded to your work, and also we made a film together that
we did
you know, did the rounds on socials, and there was a great deal of response to that. So thank you very much.
Yeah, it was great. I enjoyed
the
it.
Book commission. And I think a lovely way to work together. So I was going to talk to you about collaborative working.
Yeah.
Because obviously putting an exhibition together is about collaboration. In fact, even making prints sometimes requires you to collaborate.
Yeah.
I know you really value talking and sharing ideas with people.
Yeah. Yeah. I've come to collaboration really late. If you'd asked me that question 10 years ago, I can't remember if it was even possibly you, and I just said, I don't collaborate.
Like being on the studio, not me.
And actually, I've come really late to it and realised that it's... I mean, I'm going to reel off some names now by way of thanking people as well, if that's okay. But your input was extraordinary and pushed me and kind of... It's an extraordinary thing. And the book I've made, I made with Kevin Mount, who's probably hiding. So Kevin will be in here somewhere, and I wouldn't make books without him. And it's completely a collaboration. It's completely... It's a process of you start and you make yourself vulnerable by having an idea or expressing an idea or trying to draw it or write it. And then somebody... It's a trust relationship, because somebody who you trust will come back and say, I don't think you can say that, or that's not really right, or this bit is great, or that's too much, and you go back and you do it again. And eventually what's honed and formed is wonderful. And I view all the moth works as a collaboration with the moths. It wouldn't happen without them. I view the work here as a collaboration with place.
Yeah.
So it goes beyond the human a long way, and that's what I would say. I mean, this show is hung by Lisa Wright, who is here, and that we have talked all year. She has been on the end of the phone when I've said, what do you think about this? And I've been through tapestries and hangings and projections and...
Say that for the next one.
And all these things. And it's that lovely trusting, I'm going to make an app, you know, being able to just say something that, you know, when they say yes, or you really don't want to do that. Or they bring a little idea. And I'm trying to think of it. I had a really good example of...
Did I say that a lot?
No.
I might have said something.
You said no. You're not doing that. Or even just the kind of like the idea that a drawing or a sequence of drawings can be read in two ways is something that would occur, and then you think, shall I say that? And if you've got somebody that you're in conversation with that you trust, and they say, that's good, elaborate, and off you go, and a bit more comes in. So I think it's really valuable.
And this beautiful piece. Was physically printed by
Simon. So yes. Simon's at the back. Yeah. Simon Marsh is a master printmaker that you're very lucky to have living in this county. Mm-hmm. And that's an absolute classic example. So most printmakers are probably more aware of this than most people, that it's a collaboration. Mm-hmm.
So you print
that word is almost too big. It's a process or something that is happening, and you bring something and they bring something else, and you bring something, and you end up with something more always in that conversation. But it is a trust, it does have to be trusting, which is quite hard.
And you do print some on your own in the studio as well?
So I print most of them on my own. Yeah. Most of them are printed by me, because I still can't make my mind up and hand finish them and fiddling around at the end. Whereas I can't reasonably say to Simon, or have tried to say Simon, I want it like, you know, you can't to some bit Simon.
Yeah. And you do have a very beautiful studio near Dartmouth.
Yes.
Which is a beautiful part of the world.
I do. And I work with other printmakers as well, and it's I think that's all I want to say. I think it's taken me a long time to learn about collaboration, and possibly I would be wacky and say that somewhere between printmaking and moths I had to learn to do it.
Well, I know you've got some thank yous. Would you like to do those now before we take some questions?
Yes. I have just need to thank Karen. Thank you for having me here again, Karen. Karen, I have to say, Karen... But one of my most lost bits of time when I was wobbling around, not knowing what I was going to do again, Karen said, come to Kessel. Just come to Kessel. And I really didn't know what I was doing. So I'm really grateful to you, Karen, for having me twice. And I love being here. I love making the moth record. That's great fun. And Sam and Raya, absolutely, without whom Kessel doesn't function, does it? And Adam's here somewhere as well. It's a team. Wonderful. Lisa, I've already thanked you, Lisa, darling, you were so... Lisa?
It's been an absolute pleasure to be part of this journey. And yeah. Amazing.
Thank you. Been wonderful. Kevin Mount, who I've already name-checked, but is somewhere...
Third row,
are you?
Yeah.
Kevin, there you are. I would not... I don't think of myself as a writer. I was a B student at school with it in English, although I loved it. And Kevin does so much more than... put the books together. He stops me from making a complete tit of myself. That's what Kevin does. Lara, thank you for being here and doing that. Longer term, I need to thank Meryl Ainsley of Radley Gallery, who is my long-term gallerist, who is also amazing and cajoles and loves me on equal measure. And Paul. Where are you, Paul? Paul is my amazing other half. He puts up with me and has spent all week just doing things when I needed to. And Simon, I've already thanked you, Simon, for being a great printer. And I would like to thank Kessel Barton, the place, and the moths.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Right, well, we've got about 5 or 10 minutes for questions. And I know there must be a question in there somewhere. Yes.
Can I ask a practical one regarding the moths? The moths don't often stand still. So do you work with a photograph? Do you freeze them? Or how do you get more image?
So moths do stay still. They stay still most of the day. So I'll wind that back. We have more day-flying moths than we do butterflies. That's something that's little known. So obviously, sure, if you see them out in the day, they're moving around. But most of the night flying moths I have... Have you ever seen a light trap? Have you ever seen been done any mothing?
I have one, yes.
Yeah, you have one. So you see them in the morning. They're just incredibly still. And the bigger they are...
Well, some of them.
Some of them, yeah. So the little ones fly, but the big boys will generally stay still. And they'll even sit on your drawing desk. So I have sketchbooks full of lists and drawings.
Okay.
Of moths, and then I take hundreds of photos.
Visit specimens in museums.
And I visit specimens in museums. Actually, that's been the most useful thing, and I went to a really interesting lecture in France, which sounds very highbrow, but it just was how it happened, for a natural historian who was saying how important symmetry is to the human brain for learning, and how tuned into we are to symmetry and tiny bits of symmetry, that asymmetry. So looking at pin specimens, weird, dusty, gross, horrible, in a way, is also an extraordinary learning process. And they're very different pins to the closed. So the closed ones, if you have a moth trap, you know this, the closed ones looked at upside down really often look like a small rodent or reptile. They're quite... they're trying to look like something else. And by the time they're pinned, they're generally open and trying to look like something to frighten you off. But I tell you, if I might... maybe talk too much. There's a thing called disruptive patterning, which moths have, which is Mel Millens here as well, who also draws moths. If you try to draw a moth, it's exceptionally difficult to draw because its patterning is designed to stop you seeing the form. Mm-hmm. And it makes them very, very difficult. But that's the answer. Mm-hmm. A mixture.
Thanks, sir. Question? Yeah.
So it's an unformed thought, really, but you, when you were speaking about your work, you made it clear that you had an interest in philosophy, in particular Eastern philosophy, and the work behind you on this wall speaks to extinction. And I just was curious around whether the moth has any mythological significance to you, or have you tuned into to yeah, the moth is a mythological being.
Not mythological. I mean, I'm very aware. I was talking to your partner, John, at lunchtime about how kind of threaded through literature they are. I kind of didn't want to go there at first. I was very much, this is about a vanishing species, this is about ecological collapse, and this is about how can I serve, how can I be doing, playing my part in raising awareness about ecological collapse. I went in very much with that in mind. And then what happened as I started researching, and not only are there some extraordinary scientific things going on, but I became more and more and more aware of a sense of their presence in the world that perhaps not mythological, but certainly a poetic presence and a communicative presence. I mean, the literature around moths is really weird. It starts in the Bible. The first reference, they think, is in the Bible, which says... Does anybody know it? Does anybody know that quote exactly? It's something about store not up your possessions for rust and moths. Mm-hmm. It's pretty negative. Mm-hmm. And then there's the waves, Virginia Woolf's waves, and I mean, that's another series to come, the waves. Yeah. So not so much mythological, but yes, communicative, and yes, sentient. I became more and more and more aware of their sentience as I went on.
Can you talk a little about poetry and its importance to your work and your process?
I can. I will feel out of my depth, but I can. It's just central, in a way, as central as drawing.
Has it been from the start a parallel with drawing?
Or yeah.
Did you grow into it?
No. I remember my teacher in Paris reciting Eliot to me. And thinking, and being, nobody had, I mean, I'd done English O-level and A-level, but I didn't realise that poetry was something else that existed in the air and the space that people had in their memories. And so it has always been, and I am always, I was talking to John at lunch about, I learnt only this week, I think from Anne Enright, the writer Anne Enright, I think I was listening to her talking, and she was saying that... They're not quite sure which bit of our brains is responsible for insight and imagination. They're not quite sure where that, which is probably a conversation between the two halves, but they're not quite sure. But they have found through MRI scans that when we experience a new, exciting, poetic piece of poetry or a metaphor in particular, a particular bit of our brain lights up and becomes hyperactive with... Exactly what poetry does, which is, you know, that thing about makes an image that means something else that you half don't understand, and you journey, you know, it's very exciting as you find your way through a piece of poetry. And that lights up a bit of our brain, and that scrolling and swiping shuts down exactly that bit of our brain. Too quick. And we're not making any connections within here because we're just doing... So I don't know, I digress. I read a bit of poetry every day, usually before I start.
And in the new publication, you quote John Burnside?
I quote John Burnside. I've only found John Burnside in the last few years, which is, to my shame, really amazing, extraordinary poet who died recently. I love a lot of American poets, Charles Wright, W.S. Merwin. I mean, I just read a lot of poems. Don't know if that answers the question, Anna.
It's just really good. I just don't remember if that's a dim
wick
on Instagram.
I'm on Instagram too, you know, just do it. But I think that piece of information has gone in. Mm-hmm.
Can I?
Yes.
It's just a picking up the poetry kind of reference. I think now that we're in a world that's absolutely full of images, that every day you're most probably seeing thousands of images, and how you can read those thousands of images I can never really understand, and in what way they are a part of your life. But your point about drawing, and especially when it's a drawing that's very specific to a thing, the act of doing it, the effort that's in this room, is a very visible, very physical sign of effort, looking closely at nature. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether you would get that kind of sense of the effort taken, though effort is made when photographs are taken.
But I think the way the drawing translates the world is the way that we get very close to the images that are made by hand, which is very different from that which is made by machine.
I think how old it is. It's with what we've done along with dancing and... I wrote something down. I did write something down as I wanted to try to remember to say about it else. About so what I've written down is, so drawing practice then becomes not only a way of speaking about the world, it's a way of bringing forth the world, much like I think poetry brings forth the world. It brings something more into the world than is already there, that refuses to be reduced to objects, but is animate and laden with meaning.
Well, this is the nice thing about poetry, when they say, if you want language that's dull, listen to politicians. But if you want words to be magic, you read poetry.
Yeah. I think it's good for... I think the world needs poets and engineers. That's what I really think we need now. Probably poets more than drawers.
I think we're going to take one more question.
Okay. In your biography, we got that moment when you were painting again after all the schools.
Yes.
But the thing I'm really... You were such a good painter, and then you went black and white, and black and black, and grey, and... something happened around then. I was just wondering, capturing moments in colour, the sea or the reeds, became something that was just as good black and white. And how did it come about?
I don't know, Simon, and I'm trying to remember when it happened as well. I used to take me all year to make four paintings, and I think that was a sense as well.
I remember you saying, oh, I've just discovered black.
Yes.
That was it. And there was a night painting, sort of famous ones, or Rego's, mysterious, and it was all happening in the dark.
I think, without insulting any of the extraordinary painters that are in this room, and I absolutely who I adore and respect, for me, I needed to... Painting has a lot of... I needed to somehow step more out of the way and just simplifying the material. I think this is the honest answer. Simplifying the materials right down to one bit of stick of pencil or charcoal or whatever and one piece of paper allowed me to even more just disappear, just stay open and disappear and let the 10,000 things come to me, is the way. And I don't think I was a terribly good painter. I think I was struggling so hard juggling all the colours and the different textures and choices and stuff that I knew. I think that's the honest answer.
Final question.
I was just wondering, you talk about collaboration in many areas of your practice, but I was also just thinking about the two publications that we have here, and the little concertina one, and your relationship to nature writers and naturalists as another kind of collaboration.
Yeah.
And speak to that, and maybe just also describe what those two publications are.
Yeah, okay. Well, have you got one there?
I'll get you one.
So that's just... Actually, that started here, because the first mopping thing I did here with the Cornish Moth Group, I was really nervous, because I thought, I know nothing. I know about 12 moths. And I've got to speak to this group of people, and what I was met with was this extraordinary generosity and excitement and interest. And I think they felt, wow, somebody's interested in our weird little niche world that we live in. And every single naturalist I've met... Dr. John Fanshawe isn't here, but Mark Cocker, Peter. So the essay on the back of this little thing, which we made with Kevin and Lara for this project, that essay is by Peter Maron, who's probably one of the greatest field naturalists alive today. I met him at Radley. He came and did some talks for us, and then I wrote to him and said, I'm doing this project. And I'd read his book on extinction, which is extremely readable, and I really recommend it, called After They're Gone. And it's a really, really good view on the natural element of extinction. Anyway, and he signs off his letters, please write to me again, Sarah. Please ask more questions. And that's how it's been. So I have found naturalists to be unbelievably generous and willing to collaborate.
Great question.
Great
Thank
question.
You.
Thanks, everyone.
So we'll be around for a bit longer if you'd like to speak to Sarah.
Yeah. You were going to say something. Were you going to say something about?
Oh well, we at the museum would really like the work that we commissioned to come into our collection. But like museums all around the country, we don't have our own funds to purchase work. I'm in the process of applying to the V&A purchase grant. We have other funds committed, but we are just short of the final amounts to make it happen, shall we say. So if anybody does want to contribute, you know, please contact me at RAM in Exeter. And I'm very positive that somehow we'll make this work and it will come into our collection. It's been a wonderful afternoon. And thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you.